Come on, Batman, it's Christmas Eve. Let's kick back and get into the spirit.
The Joker's escaped from Arkham Asylum, Robin.
And you really think he's gonna make his move on Christmas Eve? Even scum spend the holidays with their families.
He has no family.
Okay, I'll make a deal with you. If we go out on patrol and Gotham is quiet with no sign of the Joker, we come back here, have Christmas dinner, and watch It's a Wonderful Life.
You know, I've never seen that. I could never get past the title.
I am from beyond. Listen, and all you desire will be yours. Welcome to Spider-Man and the Secret Wars. Prepare for battle.
Nativity Stories.
Welcome to Brattleworld. I am your host, the ever-amazing, ever-spectacular Spider-Dan. And in this podcast, I spotlight entertainment's best-kept secrets that a mainstream audience may find boring. And welcome to Alternativity Stories, a month-long look at alternative stories set around the most wonderful time of the year. And today we're talking Batman. Noel. Just in time for Christmas. We're going to be talking about a Christmas Carol Dickensian-inspired Batman tale. You might think those two things might not go together that well, but you'd be surprised. And I'm here once again, unfortunately, not unfortunately, because he's a lovely guy and one of my podcast mentors. Dan Kietis is here because, unfortunately, we did record in his house, but it didn't record, so we're doing it again. And he's magnanimously come back and found time in this very busy period of everyone's lives in the year to come and do this once again. I'm so happy and so glad we're able to find the time, and I really do appreciate it. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure to return to Prattle World, my friend. You know that. Very happy to discuss some Lieber May ho, ho, ho. in this festive episode with you.
Absolutely. I'm glad you suggested this. You suggested this way back when we did our Batman Outsiders triple bill of comics set around Christmas, which was an interesting selection of stories, varied in kind of quality and the ones we liked. But you definitely suggested Batman Noel at that point. So I'm very, very glad you did. I'm sure we have a lot to say, but before we get started, Dan, tell us a little bit about Batman Noel.
Okay, well, it's one of those books that I'm surprised nobody had attempted before, and who knows, comics being this enormous sort of black hole you can fall into, maybe somebody has, but as far as I'm aware, this is the first attempt to sort of retell a Christmas Carol kind of story through the lens of Batman. You and I are both fans of Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale's collaborations, one of which included Haunted Night, which had festive Christmas Carol-y kind of elements to it. But this is the first that I'm aware of attempt to sort of reframe the Christmas Carol story around Batman. And it's a very apt analogy, because you've got a very wealthy, reclusive person who might have started out with good intentions, has become increasingly sort of jaded and misanthropic over the years. We see how their trauma response has been to sort of like push them deeper and deeper into a state of isolation. And in so doing, they're slowly drifting further and further away from the person that they want to become. And obviously that's very much Christmas Carol. And there are lots of interpretations of Batman where that's true. You know, I'm a huge fan of the Snyderverse. I love the Ben Affleck version of Batman, and I quite like, having seen so many screen iterations of Batman before, I lauded that for being able to go to some pretty dark places. It's like, you, as much as I'm conscious of the fact that, you know, Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns is kind of a bit overplayed out now, I think it's kind of interesting to look at if this is the kind of person that Batman is, if you stretch that out as far as you can, what does this guy look like 20 years down the line? You know, of course he's going to be jaded. Of course he's going to be cynical. Of course he's only going to see the bad in the world. Of course he's going to see everything through the lens of risk management, you know, and risk aversion. So like, he's going to take a preemptive strike at something that he considers a risk. And in so doing, he just loses that little bit more of his humanity every day until somebody, in both of these stories, in the Snyderverse and in Batman Noel, we see Superman reintroduced into his humanity, which is lovely. I'm skipping ahead of myself a little bit here.
That's all right. That's all right.
But yeah, that's sort of it in a nutshell. It is a gorgeously drawn and painted retelling or analogy even of A Christmas Carol, because I think A Christmas Carol, the story, the Dickens story, does exist in this story because it's used as kind of a framing device.
Yeah.
But it's very much sort of like using Bruce Wayne as an analogy for Ebenezer Scrooge.
Absolutely. I think you've described it wonderfully, Dan. So I think that's gets a good kind of flavour in it. Taste of what this book is about. And I love a good kind of one-shot kind of Batman story. It doesn't need to be part of an ongoing series. It doesn't necessarily need to be in continuity. Like, this could be in or out of continuity, I think, as you so choose and where you want to place it within the continuity. I think it kind of, and for me, I know, not necessarily for yourself, but I think some of the best DC stories are kind of one-off or kind of contained to a degree for me, or you know, they might be in a parallel universe or something like that, but for me those are the ones that seem to resonate and seem stronger to me. But again, I'm more of a Marvel boy than a DC boy. Not that either is worse or better than the other. I've just kind of leaned that way.
No, I agree. And go on a little bit of a tangent, I think it's really interesting. I don't know if you've seen this, but whenever something new that's like either superhero-y or Star Wars or Star Trek or anything like that comes out, there's always like someone in the comment section saying, is this canon? I think canon is kind of, it's fun to catch up with initially, but I think after a while, especially after more than a decade, I think canon becomes a bit of a yoke around your neck, as we're finding at the moment, again, just to be tangential, with sort of the MCU, just like, yeah. Okay, well, let's look in some of the less explored versions of the universe. Who else can we, like, we're getting Echo, for example, in the new year. I mean, I'm excited for it.
Yeah.
Who would have thought we'd see that, you know?
Exactly.
And I think what I love about this this story is that, like A Christmas Carol itself, it's kind of timeless. Like you say, it's not tied into any particular chronology. You know, it's not post-crisis. It's not post. It's not post-Flashpoint. It's not post-Rebirth. You know, it's just a nice self-contained Batman story. Now, that said, we've got a veteran Batman. We've got a Gotham that has accommodated a Batman for a number of years. We've got a Robin who is as dead as a doornail. And this must be distinctly understood, or nothing wonderful can come of this story I'm about to relate.
big spoilers for like an 80, well, not 80, but, well, we're talking 30-year-old, probably as old as me, 35-year-old story of Jason Todd being killed. It's potentially Jason Todd. I can't think of any other dead Robins off the top of my head that have, well, I mean, they've all, I guess there was Stephanie Brown, but she came back as well. So they're all coming,
yeah.
All Robins.
And it's not, nobody says it's Jason Todd, but we are told that there's a Robin who is, yeah, who is no longer with us. And I don't know about you, but like, as much as I enjoy the Under the Red Hood story and the stuff that Judd Winnick has done with Jason Todd, I've not seen anything yet that has made me believe, you know, I'm really glad they brought back Jason Todd. I think he's much more useful as a cautionary tale than he is as a character, but that might be because, I mean, I know that I've heard lots of people say amazing things about Red Hood and the Outlaws.
Okay.
I think the post-Rebirth run on that is meant to be amazing. I've not read it myself. That's just another little tangent, but I've still not quite warmed to Jason Todd or Damian Wayne, actually.
Fair enough. That's fine. Controversial takes yet again from Dan. It's funny you mention that, because this year they are releasing, because they did, obviously it was a vote. It was a telephone in vote whether new Robin, fairly new, relative terms, to Dick Grayson, should die or not. And controversially, the fans voted him to die, so he died. But they did ink, draw, and create a story where he lived, which is being officially released, I think, this year or next year. I guess it would be, is it 1988? I want to say it's 1988, because I was born then, and I think that's when it came out.
It was thereabouts.
Yeah, just, 88, 89, maybe.
Let me ask Dr. Google.
Dr. Google. Oh, I love that. That's an obscure Batman villain, Dr. Google.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, Batman issue 426 to 429, 1988.
There you go. There we go. So, yeah, 35 years. So, yeah, they're finally going to tell that story. So you're going to get the ending you want, I guess, maybe. Did you want him to live? Did you want him dead? I'm not sure. I'm not sure where you land.
I'm not sure because I think I wanted him dead, but I think I wanted him to stay dead, because if we didn't get Jason Todd coming and going, then we wouldn't have got Tim Drake. And I love Tim Drake. Tim Drake is probably my joint first favorite Robin with Dick Grayson.
Agreed. I agree with you, and Tony Farina would say the same thing as well. Tim Drake all the way.
I'm so sorry. I brought you on this little tangent. So
it's all right. It's all right. Go back to
Christmas Carol. So it's just going to be that Christmas Carol is 180 years old, and it's very, very kind of, if we look at like what England was like in that sort of time, it's sort of pre- obviously, long time before National Health Service, long time before the welfare state. So it's very sort of cutthroat. You've got the early days of capitalism, and you've got massive wealth sitting next to abject poverty. And it's an economic model that we seem to be racing back towards at the minute, not to get too political. I found it quite interesting that Charles Dickens was quite famously disappointed with how well the book sold back in 1843. Apparently, it made £726 in sales, which is roughly 80 grand. But apparently, it wasn't all that profitable, because he was really, really specific about how he wanted the book to be covered and bound,
right.
And he wanted this to be a sort of a gift that wealthy people could give one another. And to remind them of just the inequality in which they live, and to be a bit kinder and a bit more charitable, which weirdly and we live in an age of sort of, you know, where businesses and corporations are waving their corporate social responsibility flags aloft for us all to see, and like, you know, we see greenwashing and rainbow washing and all these attempts by corporations to appear like they're soulful, and they want none of that shit back then. Like they didn't even try to hide their exploitation and their evil and their greed. Are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses? We have a wealthy industrialist who has become increasingly sort of dismissive of the downtrodden, of the less fortunate. And when we open in Batman Noel, in which he teams with one half of the Oasis duo. No, in Batman Noel, we sort of were introduced to a Batman who is very much in sort of stalking Batman mode. He's on the trail of someone who turns out to be a version of Bob Cratchit, and we see a narrator who is all the way through telling the story of a Christmas, a very, very heavily paraphrased version of the story of A Christmas Carol, all the way through. So we see Batman chasing Bob Cratchit, who in this version is a mule for the Joker. He's picking up and delivering money, and Batman sort of like catches up with him. He puts the fright on him. He scares him away, and he says he's just kind of like, he's going to surveil him and see if he leads him to the Joker. And he's kind of has this really sneering attitude towards Bob Cratchit. And it's in stark contrast, I must say, to the art style, which is just gorgeous. You know, we've got this, we've got these lavishly painted panels. You've got the very, very beautiful lettering. You've got even Batman's costume is so meticulously and lovingly designed. Where do you stand on sort of like how Lieber made it? Because he does have a very distinctive way of drawing Batman, and it's fairly consistent as well. Do you like his?
I do. Rendering? I really do. I like the shaped cowl. It's very expressive, and it's very reminds me a lot of the Christian Bale cowl, which had that real big kind of scolding kind of eyebrows. That
it's frown. Very angular as well, isn't it?
Yeah, there's something about it that I really like. I love that the cowl bleeds into the emblem and the cape all in one. I think that's a wonderful design. I'm surprised no one added that kind of design, that aspect before, because he could just slip that on and off quite easily, the whole thing, tactically if he needs to. I feel like that, you know, if he was on fire or something, he could just like straight off. But I love that style. I kind of like the military combat trousers as well, and the the realistic belt, but also like the top half is a bit more like the armoring of, say, the Batman film, the Robert Pattinson version. It's kind of a bit more like metallic and segmented, or maybe something like Arkham Knight as well, kind of similar to that. So it's an interesting mix.
It is, yeah. I really like it. I think especially in the Batman as well, they try to make everything look kind of army surplus almost.
Yeah.
I remember looking at the special features and the costume design and saying, well, these boots are, you know, German special forces, or these combat trousers are Israeli police or whatever. So it's really interesting, sort of like he's taking sort of bits and pieces from wherever and just putting together this very sort of jerry-rig looking bat suit. And while it's not my favorite, sure, it's growing on me. And I think this is a slightly more evolved version of this. I think Lee Bermejo did draw Batman like this prior to Noel. He appears in the Joker graphic novel briefly that he did with Brian Azzarello. But I think it works very well in this because this is Batman who is kind of like he's retreating inwards. And so this costume has become it's an armor, it's a shell. And we see behind it, there's like some scenes in the Batcave where we see that he used to have more of the sort of the comic accurate suit, where he was literally exposed, he was vulnerable. And I just thought it was a nice bit of, if it was a film, I'd be calling it production design, you know, it's telling us a bit of a story about the character through the visual, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, what you were saying earlier, I really loved how he was brave and carefree and rebellious when he was younger, because but he was more open to the world. He believed in Gotham. He believed in Harvey Dent or whatever. He believed it could be a better place. But as he's gotten older, he's seen more of the world. He's becoming more emotionally distant. The armor is piling on. So because he's physically is becoming older, more vulnerable that way. But also he's like, he's been hurt before and he's damaged and he doesn't want to be hurt again. So again, that distancing himself from his friends, his family, Alfred, Superman, Catwoman, all these characters to a degree is making his life worse. Like he's not living, he's surviving Gotham as opposed to kind of, you know, embracing life with all its, you know, its grace and beauty as well as its dark and visceral nature at the same time. So yeah, I think it's a wonderful little dichotomy going on there with the physical, the, you know, the storyline, but then his emotional stakes as well in it. I think that's a great thing to highlight in this story. Wonderful.
For sure, yeah. And it's just occurred to me as well, and I'm surprised it's taken this long being a big Batman 89 fan that I am, but he's literally following Bob the Goon.
Oh, yeah.
So Bob goes back to his apartment, and we see he has a little boy called Tim. Of course he does. Who's, you know, he's got a gammy leg, and we see that they're living in quite abject poverty. And this poor kid's just he's got a dead tree that someone's thrown out, or a dead pot plant someone's thrown out, and he's tried to decorate it with a bit of broken bottle and a discarded can and a toy soldier and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just heartbreakingly sad. And there's a bit in the background where he's sort of like, you know, Bob's talking with little Timmy, and we see in the background a picture of a family portrait, and there's the, you know, Bob, Tim, and the mother in there. And we never learn anything about what's happened to her, whether she's died, whether she's left. But it kind of put me in mind of The Killing Joke a little bit, and just this idea of the pathos of the you know, love lost and what happens to someone when the human relationships are taken away from them, and how that hardens them and warps them. And it's a nice parallel to what's going on with Batman there as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I will say, like, there's a lot of kind of critiques, I think, that was it, am I saying Biermo? Is that right? Biermo?
Bermejo,
sorry. Apologies.
I believe so. I've not actually heard it said out loud.
Right. I'm gonna go with your pronunciation.
That's how I've been saying it, and no one's corrected me yet. So
yeah, who knows? But there you go. It's one of those things those names you don't quite hear out loud, but you just give it your best stab.
Exactly.
I prefer that one, I think, than mine. But yes, I think that I read an interview, I think it was on MTV, believe it or not. They did interviews with comic creators. surprisingly, but he was talking about the flashbacks of some of the characters, like you were saying, seeing the Robin and Batman in those old costumes fighting Catwoman in the 40s outfit she has, that purple number. And his style does lend itself to dark and gritty Batman stories, like here as well, like does do that. But even he's saying it doesn't need to all be gritty and dark and, you know, unhappy stories. Like, we can tell light and adventurous and joyful superhero stories as well. They don't have to be dark, gritty, Dark Knight tales. And it's quite interesting that his style is the opposite of what he's almost kind of, and he's, you know, he's made like books like the Joker, a Joker book, and, you know, where they are dark and gritty, but he's like, I love dark and gritty when it calls for it, but also let's have the opposite end of the spectrum as well.
Yeah, for sure. And there's an eclecticism to this book, especially in the flashback sequences where we see, you know, this is Batman, just he's gone through different iterations in the real world. He's gone through different iterations in this. And I love it's a very short book, but it communicates a lot of history. And we've got this sequence in the Batcave where he's brooding and he's discussing with Alfred. And it's very sort of reminiscent of BVS, where Alfred's saying, look, be careful you don't get lost in this monster of yours, you know. And there's a moment where, just like Scrooge sees the ghost of Marley sort of in his door knocker and in the tiles around the fireplace, we see Batman look over to, you know, the Robin costume where he keeps it displayed. Which is a trope that's gone back almost back to 1988, you know.
Yeah.
So he keeps Jason. I think even after Jason comes back, he keeps the costume just as a reminder to himself of, like, this is what will happen if you continue to endanger people.
And it happens in the animated movie because he goes, I think Alfred says, should I take it down? Shall I put it away? And he goes, nothing's changed. And then you get,
you're absolutely right. Yeah.
And then you have that little flashback where Robin puts on the suit for the very first time and he says it's the best day of his life. And it's
heartbreaking.
It's fucking hell. It's definitely.
But yeah. I think that, minus the flashback thing that happens in the book as well. It's been a while since I've read Under the Red Hood, but that rings a bell. So we see Batman look over to the Robin costume. It sort of, it almost comes alive for a moment. And we see just a Robin just looking at him in sort of like abject terror. And it's like, is it terror at, you know, seeing the Joker standing over him with a crowbar, or is it terror at seeing what Bruce has become, you know? And I quite like that. And so Alfred just kind of left Bruce alone, and we see him start coughing and spluttering, and I don't think this was the first time I've seen this done before, I think, except maybe in the animated series episode Heart of Ice, where Batman has a cold. And I just thought that was quite charming because, you know, again, he's retreating behind all these layers of armor, but we see that little manifestation of his vulnerability there, how he's, you know, he's standing on a gargoyle and he's coughing and sniffling and stuff. Colds are the great leveler, aren't they? You know, like, no matter how healthy we are, no matter how well we protect ourselves, we always find ourselves getting them. And I think and they always make it, no matter how, what we've endured, they always make us feel like absolute crap. And I quite like that they've sort of like put Batman through that, because that again just chips away at that level of mythology, if you like. Because I get a bit exasperated whenever we get sort of the Bat God version of Batman.
I was just about to say that.
Where he's omnipotent and he's kind of like a bit of a Mary Sue. Almost.
I agree.
Are people still saying that in 2023?
I don't know. I'm sure there's another phrase for it now, but I think Bat God is a good phrase to use, because again, it's like, oh, he's got prep time. He can beat anyone with prep time. It's like, oh, fucking don't care. Like, I'm absolutely sick of those conversations now. I used to like them when I was a kid, when it was like, you know, you didn't have the internet to go and research this shit. You could just go, Batman would win because of this, or Superman would win because of this. Now it's like, oh, well, I've done all this research and here's all my proof. And blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, it was a fun idea, but now I'm just like, I don't care. Like, I see posts every single day, like, who would win? Who would win? Who would win?
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, I still watch Death Battle on YouTube and I still enjoy it, but that is very, very well researched. I will give it that. But, you know, there's a lot of scientific stuff going on there as well that they work out. But I don't do those kind of things anymore. I think the pinnacle of that was, you know, BVS, which we've covered, Civil War, which we've also covered on the same podcast. And that was it for me. I was kind of done with it then.
Yeah.
Kind of the hero versus hero thing. But yeah, I agree. I think he is, again, criticizing that idea of Batman being the all-powerful and, you know, oh, I've got kryptonite in my pocket. I've got this, I've got that. I've got this backup plan. I've got this. I've got a robot suit hiding away. You know, I've got all the heroes flying in to help me. You know, I like it every now and again. Again, I'm a little sick of the Joker as well. I'll be honest. I will cherry pick the Joker appearances because, again, it's just that I feel like he's overdone, overused, and it becomes less interesting because of it. For me, those big villains, you need to use them less because when they do turn up, you know shit's going to hit the fan. So when the Joker Red Skull wouldn't be in every single issue of Captain America. He would turn up maybe every 6 months, 8 months. And when he did turn up, you went, okay, this is serious now. You know, and that's what I think of the Joker. And I think if you put him in every single book, every single thing, it diminishes his power. Like it happened in the 90s with the Punisher when he had 5 comics. The same with Wolverine, the same with any of those characters. It just...
Deadpool.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. especially at Comic-Con. Don't get me started on Deadpool cosplayers. My God. But no, I think he's saying that... And again, like, Spider-Man is a character that I see get colds more often than Batman, which seems almost the reverse of that, because Batman's a very human character. And those, for me, are the most interesting stories. Like you were talking about the fractured psyche and he's pushing his body to those limits. Like... years ago, I covered Batman Venom when he gets hooked on, you know, steroids and trying to, because he wasn't strong enough to save a child. Like that, and that is fucking interesting to me. The stories where he's, you know, a god, you know, fighting hand to hand with Darkseid is not interesting to me, really. We see Batman often get injured, like he'll have a bad leg or a bad back or a, you know, his arm. Like, again, I did a 10 Nights of the Beast with Cagey Beast. Again, can't beat the Cagey Beast, so he has to lock him underground and possibly does not call the police. Maybe not. Who knows? Might leave him for dead. But those are my kind of Batman stories that I go to because, again, I want to see him in danger. I want to see him struggle. I want to see him not solve the puzzle immediately. You know, it needs to show like he struggles and he's going to get there and we're rooting for him and he will get there. But I want that journey. And I think that with a lot of those comics and those type of stories, you don't get it.
For sure.
Should we continue to sort of like overview the story?
Yeah, let's go back to, let's get off of these tangents. But yeah, we've kind of talked about it. Let's talk about the three ghosts.
We've been introduced to sort of like the analog for Marley's ghost, which is that little sort of brief flash of seeing Robin. And then acting on a tip from Commissioner Gordon, Batman comes face to face with the ghost of Christmas past, who is Catwoman in this case. So he's tipped off to a series of burglaries. And of course, he sees Catwoman in a sort of her modern 21st century black, almost tactical Catwoman suit. And she's, Batman's chasing her across the rooftops. And Catwoman's trying to be sort of flirtatious and fun. And Batman's having absolutely none of it. And he's getting angry. And he's literally sort of like shouting at her face. You see like little flecks of spit flying at her. It's like, dude, you've got a cold. Come on.
Dude, don't kiss me, whatever you do.
And you see, and she's sort of like, what happened to you? This used to be fun, you know, and don't look at me like you didn't used to enjoy it too. And we see the first little kind of flashback panels where you see sort of like Batman, he's wearing the slightly more comic accurate version of the suit. It's still fairly tactical. But it's got the yellow oval with the bat in it, and he's got a little bit of a smirk on his face. And as you say, that's when we see Catwoman in the kind of 40s purple suit with the dress and the slit up the leg and the plunging neckline. We see a little bit of Robin in there as well. And we just get that little glimpse of when Batman and his world are a bit more fun. And so Selina's kind of just lamenting that. And they have this little fight and Catwoman actually gets the upper hand for a little bit. And then she sort of like eludes him and it transitions then into just this kind of like little greatest hits montage. There's even a little bit of a Batmobile shot that looks almost like the 60s Batmobile with the little sort of like cockpits, the twin cockpits. And then we see Batwoman sort of like go to jump across the rooftop and Batman's in pursuit and he grabs hold of a gargoyle and it breaks and he goes pointing down to the street. And so we're reminded of this isn't fun anymore. This has stakes. This has consequences. This Batman's getting older and slower and less agile. And before we know it, he's literally down on the street. And where does he land? But Crime Alley, pretty much on the spot where he saw his parents killed.
Yeah.
So that's you know, that's pretty typical end of first act fare, isn't it? You get your hero to their lowest point so they can pick themselves up again in the second act.
And he's kind of almost been humiliated by her a little bit, like personally and you know, physically and you know, in a crime fighting sense as well. Like I love that bit where he's like, I'm chasing a madman. The Joker, it's implied very early on that Bob is working for the Joker. He's escaped. Yeah. He's out. He's, you know, he's doing his thing. There's a lot of hints to it's, there's nothing specifically to say it's him, but there's enough hints to say we're probably going to see the Joker in this story.
Yeah.
And that bit where she's like, if you don't tell me what you know about the Joker, you are going to be responsible for all these people's deaths, family, whatever he's attempting to do, you're going to be locked up and I'm going to make sure you pay for this. And she's like, fucking hell. Like,
yeah.
Well, that's, I was just going to have a bit of fun with you. That was it. You know, I think she doesn't actually know anything. Is that right? Or I couldn't remember.
I believe so. I think we kind of leave her at that point.
Yeah.
But when we see Batman sort of like, sprawled in the alley and he starts to pick himself up and then we see sort of like bathed in a corona of sort of lamplight, we see Superman hovering over him and he's our ghost of Christmas present analog, because you know he's big and he's bright and he's cheerful and he's wearing a red suit and I quite like that. I thought that was a really nice bit of casting on Bermejo's part there. And as in A Christmas Carol, we get Batman, he sort of like picks he gets picked up by Superman. He's flying him around, as we all know Batman hates.
don't pick me.
You know, he has a little look at his chest as well and says, oh, you know, that's pretty bad. I think that might be pneumonia or something. And it kind of, do you know what it reminded me of? Again, it reminded me of going back to Death in the Family, where Batman loses his temper with Superman. And he actually clocks in one and he's like, ah, shit. I think I might have broken a few knuckles and, you know. And Clark, he x-rays his hand and says, no, you're not broken, but they're badly used, badly bruised. Like, it's a good thing I rolled with that punch, or you'd really fuck your arm up, basically.
You stupid. And
it just touches on this shared history the characters have, which I quite liked.
And again, Superman, it makes sense because, again, like the Christmas, the ghost of Christmas past is usually depicted as a young woman or girl.
Yeah.
I know in the Jim Carrey version, there is a very kind of almost violent and balletic kind of chase over rooftops, but they've got a very creepy ghost of Christmas past in that with like a weird little, like very innocently creepy Irish voice like, oh, hello there, Scrooge. I'm the ghost of Christmas past. And it's, it's a bit weird. It kind of sent a chill through me, but I guess that's kind of the point of that particular story anyway. But yeah, I think Superman as a character always lives in the present. He's always about saving lives. He doesn't dwell too much on his past, you know, the death of his entire race, his planet, his parents. It is all about living in that moment and possibly building to a better tomorrow. And he's a man of tomorrow. But I love that he's depicted as this golden god, because I know in like Superman Doomsday, Lex Luthor, played by James Masters, describes him as a golden god. So that imagery came back and that link to my brain, my lizard brain started communicating with the other human part of my brain and went, yes, I remember that. So it linked those things together. And he's so like magnanimous, he's so nice, and he's so friendly, even though Batman is ripping into him. Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm pretty sure when he x-rays his chest, he's like, oh, you've got a nasty cold or could be pneumonia. And he's like, what would you know? You don't get ill. or
it was some sort of prat
like that.
It's that thing that you know, being a good friend is, where which is where like you're there for your friends even when it's the last thing they want, because you know it's what they need. And this is very much what's going on here. And again, I just found that quite charming. And as in this, at this point in A Christmas Carol, we get you know, the ghost Christmas present showing Scrooge, you know, how various people in his life are spending their Christmas, like his nephew and Bob Cratchit and whatnot. And, you know, he gets to sort of like tangentially hear how these characters feel about Scrooge. In this, we've got him, you know, they see Bob and little Timmy through the window, and Batman's berating Clark. And he's saying like, look, this kid, he might seem all sweet and cute and innocent now, but it's only a matter of time until he's walking around with a gun stuffed in his belt and gang colors on, you know. And Clark's just sort of like, well, you know, that's a really horrible, cynical way to view the world. And there's even a direct callback to A Christmas Carol where Batman talks about decreasing the surplus criminal population. Yes. and Superman just gives him a real sort of WTF look.
I think there was a really good line about the way you view people and how you view the world. Like Superman views it in a very different way, and Batman is like, it's in a negative way. And I can't remember the exact kind of wording or the script.
He says, you look down on these people, and Clark replies, well, not in the way you do.
Yes, that's
because he just kind of assumes that Superman's flying above everyone aloof. And you know, when you're flying above people, how can you not feel superior to them? But we see that Clark's actually looking in on these people and their lives, and he's taking the time to see the beauty in there, no matter how sort of mundane or how, you know, how much they've fallen on hard times. He takes the time to see the beauty in people and their relationships. So we see a little bit of Jim Gordon and Barbara, it's Sarah Ressen, I believe. And we see, I'm not sure, I'm, it doesn't say that. I think it's just because she's blonde. I'm assuming it's Sarah Ressen. Again, we just see people discussing Batman and what he means to the city, you know, the good and the bad, so that he can just have that little bit of context in terms of like how he's seen by the people who are closest to him. And it's a fairly short section, because before we know it, we've got sort of Superman dropping Batman back off at his car.
Sure. I love that moment where it's very similar to in A Christmas Carol, when it's Scrooge's nephew and he visits them and he's like, oh, it's my nephew, I love him, he's great, you know, he thinks very highly of me, always invites me to the Christmas party, da 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 da. And then we go in and he's actually, they're making fun of him, criticizing him, you know, you know, humiliating him. And then we see James Gordon and a fellow police officer, which I think looks like Chief O'Hara from the 1966 Batman. But he's saying, but what if Batman went bad? What if Batman lost it? You know, he's dealing with all this darkness and the criminal element. What if he just takes it one step too far? And Gordon's like, I don't think he will, but we'll be ready, and we know what to do, and I know how to approach it were that. And Batman, I think, is taken a little bit aback by that he has.
Yeah.
But again, this is Batman who, you know, keeps files on the Justice League, all their weaknesses and everything. So
yeah.
I think even he can be like gone, oh shit, yeah, maybe they could, you know. There's I think there's Over the Edge, there's a Batman the Animated Series episode where they goes after him, very similar to that. But I like that little moment, because it puts Batman on the back heel, where someone he trusts and cares for and respects actually could potentially have a very different view of him.
Well, I mean, it's one thing if you think to yourself, oh, I think I'm maybe being a bit of a dick. But then when someone close to you says, oh, you're being a bit of a dick, you're like, oh, shit. It kind of makes you take a bit of a step back. You know, you can suspect it about yourself when someone says it to you, especially if they don't say it to you, if they say it to someone else about you and you hear it. Yeah, it's a much more impactful moment. And I like that Clark just sort of like leaves him to ponder that. But he doesn't have long to ponder it, does he? Because what happens when he gets into his car? It blows up.
Which Clark doesn't hear, surprisingly, with his great hearing. Yeah. He's like, you probably deserve that, you prick. Off I go. Metropolis awaits. Away. But yes, yeah, you are right. And then we get the introduction of the final ghost of Christmas.
Yeah, so we've got the ghost of Christmas future, who is in this story, who is the Joker. And it's, I don't know about you, but as a kid, I always used to sort of like, I was marking down time whenever I read or watched A Christmas Carol to get to the Ghost of Christmas Future, because he's scary, he's mysterious, he's ominous. And in a Batman story, you need someone who's more scary and ominous than Batman. And in this instance, it's Joker. Now, the Joker has been portrayed, again, in all kinds of ways. He's been a prankster. He's been a genuinely funny comedian. And I think scary Joker has kind of been done to death now, but when it's done really, really well, it works brilliantly. I think Scott Snyder did scary Joker phenomenally well in the end of his run on in the New 52. And I think Bermejo does a great job with scary Joker here, because Joker's usually incredibly verbose. But in this version, he says almost nothing, like the Ghost of Christmas Future. And when Joker isn't cackling and spurting bad puns and or making threats or making sort of like meta analytical jokes, you know something's a bit wrong. And there's even a bit where he's sort of like dragging Batman's body in across the snow. It's this beautiful visual, dragging him, I think, into the gates of Arkham, and you see him stifle a little giggle. And for some reason, that just really sent a shiver down my spine. It's like he's stopping himself from laughing, and that's just ugh.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it's because like Batman's not conscious to enjoy it. Like maybe we're seeing a different side to the Joker now, like because Batman's not there to appreciate his theatrics and his performance. But yeah, we see Joker sort of toss Batman into a shallow grave. And as he's sort of like clinging to life, we see a vision of the future where Gotham's sort of like descended into kind of like a bit anarchy. It's chaos. It's kind of like the end of the Joker film, you know, where there's all the fire and the rioting and the looting. Yeah. And we see these sort of like vigilantes, these sort of bare-chested vigilantes who are the
Sons of Batman, maybe.
Yeah, almost like the Sons of Batman, yeah, in The Dark Knight Returns. And they're perverting what Batman stood for. And, you know, they're much more violent. They're much more, they're much less altruistic. And he sees like, well, this is the bad example that I could be leaving. You know, this could be my legacy. This could be the legacy that I thought I wanted. I wanted to inspire people, but instead I've made them, you know, violent and sadistic and cynical. And I thought that was just a really, really nice twist on, you know, the kind of world that Batman wants to leave behind. Mm-hmm. And we see Jim Gordon go to prison for aiding and abetting him.
Yeah.
The Wayne estate being shut down, all his assets sold, and Alfred sort of like left destitute. And I think that, again, that was another one that made me think, I can't believe no one's thought to analogize A Christmas Carol with Batman before, because of course that would work brilliantly.
Yeah, I will say I do have a slight criticism at the start of the book, because I was expecting a Christmas Carol version of like Batman with the Batman characters, and it's not quite that. Now, according again to that, I'll reference that MTV interview, he did say that's what it initially started out as. It was a direct adaptation, but with Batman characters in place of those characters. Mm. So with this, it is, like you said at the start, it is somebody retelling, not you know, beat for beat, word for word, perfect, A Christmas Carol. And there is a separate parallel story going on, which mimics it to some degree, A Christmas Carol. And I think initially it threw me off a little bit, because there is a Bob, there is a Tim. So initially I was like, right, it's a direct adaptation. And then it was like, Bob is working for the Joker, so the Joker must be Scrooge.
Yeah.
And then I was like, does that really work? And I was like, my brain is doing two different things. I think by the end of the book, it made sense to me, and I could kind of married up eventually. Once I was a few pages in, I went, okay, it's not beat for beat exactly. It's two different things going on at once, which is quite clever, really. But it just took my mind a bit to kind of adjust to that form of storytelling. And I think maybe because that's what it was originally scripted as, I don't know if maybe early on there's kind of a bleed through of that original idea and it's not necessarily so clear. But I think by the end, my brain was like, yeah, I know what this is, and it makes perfect sense. But yeah, that was it was just a bit of the lines were blurred a little bit for me at the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, if it helps, I did the exact same thing. I thought there was a bit of dissonance there for me too. But again, by the time we got to the end, I was like, ah, oh, right, okay. Yeah. That makes total sense now.
Exactly. Exactly.
So we see Batman sort of like recovered from this vision of the future, and we see the glove fist sort of punching up through the earth, and see Batman dragging himself out of the grave. And, you know, I know you're a big fan of Craven's Last Hunt.
Yes.
So that's a visual that I knew you'd appreciate.
Absolutely. And there's that lovely visual as well. It's like a big splash page of Batman kind of falling into the abyss when he's thrown into the grave.
Yeah.
And that's what I loved about this, is what I found kind of chilling and disturbing, because, like, you know, the ghost of, you know, Christmas future is death in, you know, visually and just in many ways it is death. And that's what was so scary about this, is that, like you said, there's no bizarre kind of death trap. There's no Joker fish. It is just a man throwing another man into a cold, hard grave. And that is terrifying. But yeah, this big splash page of just this black abyss and Batman just tumbling through it was kind of gorgeous. It kind of reminded me of some of those 90s films like the Batman Forever, or, you know, some of the kind of dream visuals in that film and the repressed memories. And yeah, because he falls down the well, doesn't he? He falls down.
That's right. Yeah.
So I was picturing that. It's not done quite the same way in the Nolan one. It's not as quite as visually stimulating. It's kind of more realistic style of falling down a well, which is fine. You know, it fits that version of Batman. But yeah, I love that imagery. Just gorgeous. Again, the artwork, I can't fault the artwork at all on any level in this book. I have some of my misgivings about certain moments in the beginning, but the artwork is just gorgeous. Every panel is a work of art. Easy.
Yeah. Speaking of things that are chilling, I looked up what's written on the gravestone, because I couldn't remember, and it says, "Here lies a bat. He died boring and predictable, and nobody loved him," which is just the most Joker thing ever. But I think you could say that's kind of a meta commentary on the character. If you don't tell Batman stories that have a semblance of heart, if you condense Batman down to a series of tropes, like, you know, he always wins, or he's badass, or he's dark and angry and violent, then he could, in the pop culture terms, he could die boring and predictable and no one will love him anymore.
You're right. But then for the Joker, like, he's never wanted Batman unmasked, because that would be boring. That's not Batman anymore. Whoever behind the mask isn't important, because that is boring to him. So for him, you know, that character underneath that idea is just a man. It is a boring, you know, rich playboy, you know, which wouldn't interest him. And that's why he's never been that interested, even if he knows who he is in some iterations. It's never been that big a deal for him, because it's not what interests him about Batman, the idea. I guess it's very V for Vendetta. You can kill the man, but you can't kill the idea.
Exactly, yeah. So believing Batman to be dead, Joker goes into Bob's apartment to get his money. Of course, as soon as he sees a little boy there, he threatens him with, I believe, a socket wrench, because he just loves beating little boys to death with various metal tools. And just when all seems lost, Bob brings it to the yard with his baseball bat and he takes a swing at Joker, but Joker quickly puts him on the ground. And just when you think all is lost, who should crash through the window but Batman? And we see this wonderful silhouette of the wings sort of like spread as we look through the window, and then crash, we see Batman come in. He takes down the Joker, and Bob picks up the gun and he's pointing at the Joker, and he's and of course Joker loves having a gun pointed at him. he thinks there's nothing more hilarious than someone about to kill him. So, of course, he's saying, oh, yeah, go on, kill me. That'd be brilliant. That'd be hilarious. And Batman, sort of having rediscovered his humanity, just talks him down. He's like, no, I need you to be the hero your son thinks you are. And that sort of like talks Bob round. And he you know, Joker goes back to Arkham again for, you know, we can argue about the efficacy of that. But, you know, Joker goes back to Arkham. Bruce has a little nap in the Batcave. Alfred brings him a hot drink. And a little bit later, we see that we go back to Bob's apartment and someone's bringing in a luscious new Christmas tree. And someone's fixing his window where Batman broke through. And someone's giving him some employment papers from Wayne Enterprises. So, again, we see Batman now who he won't just punch the bad guy in the face. He won't just break his leg. He won't send the Joker to Arkham. He'll also address the sort of, you know, the socioeconomic issues, the desperation, the poverty that create criminals. And he'll give, you know, he's going to give this Bob, he's going to give him a good job.
Absolutely. And we learn that the Bob is actually the one that's reciting A Christmas Carol at the end, bringing it kind of full circle, which is really, really lovely and brings the whole kind of piece together. But yeah, I thought it was an amazing little book. It's, again, it's nice and short, sweet. It's familiar, yet it's, you know, it's different enough that you can get it. You know, you can read it in line with all your other favorite versions of A Christmas Carol. It's an absolute blast. I really, really enjoyed kind of reading this and discovering it. Speaking of corrupt individuals that have been visited by three ghosts, this is going to be the last comic I read on, or was the last comic I read on Comixology before it died, unfortunately. But
yeah, that's very sad, and that's actually made me question my entire relationship with comics, because I was one of those kind of early adopters of Comixology, and I slowly started phasing out my physical collection and I bought all my comics on Comixology, and they're still there, but they've now been migrated over to the Kindle app. And for my money, it's just not as good. It's not made with comics fans in mind. The shop certainly isn't as frictionless as the Comixology shop was. I don't think the bargains are as good as the Comixology shop had.
True. Couldn't agree more.
It's sad. It is sad. But yeah. I'm not gonna dwell on that. Unfortunately, three ghosts aren't going to visit Jeff Bezos. He's not going to grow a social.
Well, there was a meme not so long ago, because he did donate quite a lot of money to charity for some reason. I don't know if it was homeless charity or something like that. But somebody literally made a comment like, someone was visited by three ghosts last night.
You get like the disgustingly rich, like the Musks, the Zuckerbergs, the Bill Gateses, the tech billionaires. They could give all of their income away to charity for the rest of their lives and still be the wealthiest people in the world.
True.
So when they have these little performative charity thing, I don't know. I think maybe I'm going further and further to.
Are you becoming as jaded and cynical as the Batman in the story, Dan?
I'm actively trying not to, because I think every day I see little reminders of why people are good. I see it in, you know, my real life interactions. I see it on my increasingly rare dalliances with social media. I do think people are good. I think people generally want to do good, but I don't know. I don't think capitalism lends itself to that, generally speaking.
So you're a bit like Charles Dickens himself, then.
Well, I mean, I don't think Charles, like, I know people have read A Christmas Carol as a socialist allegory. I don't think Charles Dickens was flagrantly anti-capitalist, but if he'd seen what the world would look like in 180 years, maybe he would be.
maybe he would be. But there's, you know, I have my dalliances with cynical and jaded outlooks on life. But I'll be honest, you are a good person, and you do good, and you've done me some good by coming back and talking about this comic when we already did it for a whole hour, and you've done it again. You're an amazing human being, and you've always been very kind and generous to me with your time, with everything that you do, you and Violet especially. You know, you don't have to have me round and show me places and share meals or time, or even watching movies and, you know, whatever they might be. You know, that for me is real generosity, and I really do appreciate that. I'm with you. Sometimes I do feel like the world is a little bit on fire with the David Zaslavs taking away people's digital content they've already bought and paid for, and various other things, and the
shelving films that are more or less complete.
Yeah, that whole thing. I would have loved to have seen that Batgirl. Maybe one day it might happen, not sure, but I would absolutely die to see that. But, you know, I'm becoming more and more of a Marxist week by week, as I see more and more people having their jobs taken away and replaced with AI, or businesses finding other ways where they cannot pay people for the good work that they do. On a good note, we've got some comments just before we finish. Highly recommend this book, and Dan does as well.
Definitely.
I don't, I don't know if maybe, I have an idea, maybe next year, there is another Batman Christmas comic, or Batman related at least, that I thought maybe we could do that you might enjoy. I don't know. Maybe.
Oh, go on.
Soft Targets from Gotham Central.
I think I remember buying, was that the Greg Rucka run on?
It is, yes. So it's the Batman adjacent title. So it's the
okay.
It's the Gotham cops dealing with Batman villains. And in that particular story, the Joker has got a sniper rifle and he's going around Gotham.
He now has a machine gun, ho, ho, ho.
Absolutely, absolutely. But what's interesting is because there's actually real jeopardy, because it's not Batman here and he's not able to solve it. He's away doing some cosmic battle or something. So it's down to them to stop him, which is...
I like that. I'm up for that. I think I've got all those issues stashed away somewhere. So I will track them down and I'll give them a read for next year.
We'll have a look at that. It's not very long. I think it's like 6-issue arc or something. But I think it's one of the best Batman books ever made for my money. Ed Brubaker, Greg Rucka, you know, one does the day shift, one does the night shift. Amazing quality
awesome.
Stuff. So yeah, well, maybe we'll have a look at that next year if we find the time. Hopefully we won't have to record it twice though. Fingers crossed. Fingers
always
crossed.
A pleasure.
But I always have a blast with you, and I'm sure we'll do something else in the year as well. So Max Byrne says very simply about this, fabulous book.
Oh, I agree, Max.
I agree. I agree as well. Good, nice, succinct. You don't have to go on for an hour like we have. You can just say in one, two-word sentence. John Hammond has sent me one in very quickly just before we start. So he says, being a fan of the Charles Dickens story, this was always going to be on my to-read list. When I got wind of it, I tend to watch and read as many adaptations or interpretations of the Dickens story as I can during the festive period. This is no different, and it gets a run out each year, along with the quite wonderful artwork. It's a really wonderful story. Despite a little slacking off during the final third, still, it's an easy 4 out of 5 Batman story for me.
Yeah, I'm not mad at anything in there. I think I also have a bit of a soft spot for all kinds of adaptations of Christmas Carol. I actually directed a stage version of it.
Really?
Very long time ago. Yeah, I think
I do have a
2009.
I did when I was kind of still. I mean, I guess I'm. I did a paid acting job the other day, in fact. So I guess I'm still kind of an actor. I'm still self-employed technically. So I'm still kind of doing it, I guess. But one of my dreams was that I would play Scrooge. That was one of the roles I really wanted to do. I wanted to be Scrooge and get stuck in, because again, I love that story as well. So. Absolutely would have been a dream, but I doubt it'll happen, but you never know. Never say never.
Well, absolutely. I'm really glad that gets in someone's regular sort of Christmas Carol rotation. That makes me very happy.
Me too.
Anymore?
Me too. That's it. Just the two. But that is more than enough for me. So Dan, I know you're not really on social media anymore.
No, it's great. I heartily recommend not being on social media.
Merry Christmas, everyone. Get off social media. Don't interact with other people. Do it. No.
Put your phone down. Give your friends a hug.
Yes, exactly.
That's my advice.
Less doom scrolling and more people hugging. Whatever the term is, you know, consensual people hugging is always good. It's always good. But yes, this has been another wonderful podcast. And the final one that is coming, well, not the final one that's coming out, but the final one I'm recording, as of 2023. What a way to go out. What a way to finish off the year. I'm going to do a few more Patreon things before the end of the year, but you have been an absolute gem. You're not a Scrooge. You're not a cynic. you're one of the best people I know, and you're all of the good. You're all of the good. You're the Tim Drake of my life. You're the Tim Drake.
Oh, bless you.
You
actually,
are.
You're. I'm going to have to take a little bit of time to find a suitable analogy for you.
It's Christmas, so joy and love to everybody. If you don't celebrate Christmas, whatever holiday you do celebrate, I hope you're having a good one. Festivus or Chrismica or all of the various holidays around this year. I really appreciate everybody that's helped out this Alternativity Stories. It's always my favorite section of the year. So Andy, I'm Jack's Musings, Tony Farina, we used last year's podcast we had on Patreon. Don't know why I'm struggling. It's been a long day.
No problem. Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
If any of your listeners aren't particularly looking forward to the festive period or don't have a very good time, I really recommend Samaritans. I think they absolutely do amazing work, and they are literally always there for you. If you need to talk to someone, I find that can be incredibly helpful. If you don't already have some form of talk therapy in your life, and you feel like you need to reach out to someone, but you don't have anyone you feel comfortable to in your life that you can sort of open up to, I think the work they do is absolutely incredible.
Couldn't agree more. What a great way to end. I will leave it there. I don't need to do my spiel. You've heard it on the end of every other podcast. I think the way Dan's ended it is perfect. Go if you don't have anyone to speak to. Absolutely reach out to Samaritans. I've struggled with my mental health this year. I'm in therapy. So we all struggle, regardless of, you know, where you are in life, where you're not. We're all struggling one way or another. And especially this time of year, you know, visit your local food banks, donate what you can, if you can. They will be very, very grateful, and I'll be grateful that you've gone and done that as well. So thank you so much to the patrons. Next year is absolutely for you. You get to choose everything. Everybody that's supporting me, come on. You're all brilliant. It's not been the easiest year for me, I'll be honest, but we're still here. We're still fighting. We're still carrying on the good fight.
Still prattling.
So yes, absolutely. And as always, prepare for prattle.